final investigator I met with for this program was Dr. Stephen Chia, and to begin, we chatted about ER-positive disease, and he started out by providing an overview of endocrine therapy.
We base a lot of our endocrine treatments based on trials that were enrolled and results available over a decade ago. We now recognize that a lot of the patients that we're seeing are unfortunately ones that have relapsed after having had an adjuvant endocrine maneuver. In North America, both Canada and United States, less than 5% of patients present with stage 4 disease. So the majority present with 1 to 3 and are likely going to be at least potentially exposed to endocrine therapy, and I think for the most part are aromatase inhibitors. So it's a different sort of algorithm or pathway than the very original studies with AIs and fulvestrant were, for the most part, either hormonal naive or had tamoxifen only. I think, in my view, I still believe that to think about considering your best available agents earlier than later, within the context of the individual patient, obviously within the toxicity spectrum, I think that the combination that you mentioned of fulvestrant and aromatase inhibitor has been shown in a SWOG-led study to have a survival benefit, but predominantly in people that have never had any endocrine exposure at all. And it has yet to be replicated, and there was a European trial called the FACT trial that really didn't replicate that. So I think that's a reasonable question that's still out there and not fully, I think, answered. I think the standard combination to think about following a non-steroid aromatase inhibitor would be everolimus and exemestane, and whether one uses it right at the first line or the second line, I think, would be the preferred options that I would consider.
I'm not sure exactly how much everolimus is being used right now in practice, but you go back and look at the original data, it's a pretty impressive hazard reduction. I hear a lot about the toxicity, but I don't hear as many people talking about the hazard reduction. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you go back and look at the trials beforehand, and we were involved in a trial called EFFECT, and there was a SOPHIA trial done in the UK, the standard hormonal head-to-head trials have actually only showed very similar outcomes and not really showed much difference. So you come along in a large 700-patient trial, and you have a hazard ratio of somewhere about 0.4, or 60% relative risk reduction, and a median PFS improvement from roughly 3.5 to 10 months is, you're absolutely right, has clinical relevance. And I think if we learn to appreciate and treat the toxicities in an earlier manner, I think you're going to see more widespread use of that as we become more comfortable with dealing with the toxicities and becoming increasingly aware of them.
What do you yourself do in terms of prevention or management? The thing I hear the most about is mucositis.
Right. So you definitely need to educate your patients to inform you very early if they're starting to develop mucositis. We know that the majority of mucositis develops within the first 2 to 4 weeks. So I bring my patients back quite regularly, both at the very time when I initially see them to dispense and talk to them about the combination, but then 2 weeks and again 2 weeks after. So, you know, I have a very close follow-up, and I think if there's early signs of mucositis, there are some mouth rinses that I think we use, and different groups have sort of different cocktails of mouth rinses, but also potentially interruption or dose reduction early and then allowing it to heal and then being able to reintroduce the pill at either the full dose or the reduced dose, I think is important rather than letting it get to a more significant grade, let's say grade 3 or 4 mucositis.
In your own mind, what's the mechanism of the mucositis? It seems like it's not like a typical chemotherapy-related mucositis.
You're right. I mean, visually, it doesn't look like a typical mucositis. It's a very interesting thing, and the answer is we don't know. So, you know, I'm interested in a project that I'm trying to get off the ground, which is looking at polymorphisms associated with toxicities and whether it's a pharmacokinetic effect or some other effect, and why only, let's say, 5 to 10% of patients really develop severe mucositis. There's got to be some underlying biology behind that.
Any other comments in terms of toxicity, pulmonary toxicity? I don't know if you've seen that at all.
We have. We've done the previous trials of the single agent in Canada. I think the thing is, again, increasing awareness. Now, that can develop at any point over time, typically not as early within the first 4 weeks. I think you need to educate your patients if they're having symptoms, again, to inform you, and then you need to investigate early and, again, intervene early.
And you mentioned that, you know, you have this in your pocket to consider. I do hear a lot of people hesitating about using everolimus because of concerns about toxicities. Can you talk about the typical situation where you do use it? Do you generally wait until the patient, you know, is a little bit later line, having more symptoms? What's a typical situation where you're going to pull that out?
That's a great question because it's something that we struggle with. I'm of the belief that this is a combination that has, as we've previously discussed, showed quite significant clinical benefit. And I like to have that discussion with my patients that these are the different options available to them when they have metastatic ER-positive metastatic breast cancer and if they've had previous non-steroidals, we have different types of options. And I like to engage them, at least informing them of the options and say, listen, this probably has greater efficacy, but there is alterations in toxicity and, you know, I'm happy to go through this path and treatment with you, but we do need to manage this very carefully. And, you know, I think the ones that I tend to shy away from are the minority, and those are older patients, non-compliant patients, have comorbidities that make me worried whether they're diabetics, they have underlying pulmonary toxicities from other causes, poor nutrition, they're not eating much to begin with. Those are the ones I worry, but for the majority, the others, I present them with the options, and more often than not, they would prefer to do a more efficacious treatment, but recognizing that we need to be careful with managing the toxicities.
In terms of endocrine treatment as opposed to prevention, which I also want to ask you about, anything happen over the past, you know, 6 months, particularly at San Antonio, of note?
Well, in terms of prevention, as you know, the IBIS-2 trial was presented, which was a primary prevention trial in women of moderate risk, meaning a risk on the Gale scale, that were randomized to placebo or an aromatase inhibitor. In the setting, it was anastrozole, and basically showing more than a 50% relative risk reduction in the development of a breast cancer, whether it be in situ or invasive. And this parallels a North American trial called MAP3 that used exemestane versus placebo. So I think it really solidified and confirmed that we have two classes of drugs in the primary prevention setting, whether it be tamoxifen or raloxifen in the CIRM class, and then now the aromatase inhibitors, whether you want to use a steroidal or non-steroidal. And I think the aromatase inhibitors in general would be the preferred class because lack of development of pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis, and endometrial carcinoma, and now our ability to really monitor and manage the osteoporosis risk.
In what situations right now are you kind of bringing this up proactively with patients? And I'd wonder, for example, about LCIS.
Those are the ones. And it depends where you work. You know, where I work, we are trying to develop a high-risk pre-malignant clinic where people have ADH or, as you say, LCIS. And these are women that are higher risk based on having had a biopsy showing some proliferative changes and maybe the ones that may most likely benefit. The other group I think that's increasingly recognized is women with increased breast density. So again, the aromatase inhibitors, as you know, only work in the postmenopausal setting, but if you have a postmenopausal woman with very dense breasts, they are at possibly double the risk of the women that don't have at average risk with non-dense breasts. And so that's another patient population that might be worth targeting.
So another change or evolution that's been occurring over the last year or two is the issue of duration of adjuvant endocrine therapy, particularly the tamoxifen studies, the ADAM and ATLAS. Anything that we've learned new in that arena? I'm seeing more papers on predictors of response beyond 5 years. Can you talk about what we've learned about this whole decision and scenario? And then we can talk about how you approach it in your own practice.
Right. So, yeah, I think that with ADAM and ATLAS, they showed a couple points. Number one, 10 years of tamoxifen is better than 5 years, albeit I think that the benefit is fairly modest. It's not a 50% relative risk reduction. It's somewhere in the range of 25 to 30%, depending on the specific study. It has not yet been demonstrated that 10 years of an aromatase inhibitor is better than 5 years, but you know, I think a lot of people are trying to make some extrapolations. Those studies have been fully accrued, and we're really waiting for those studies. In terms of how to select patients, you're right. We don't have a verified or validated predictive profile that says this tumor is more sensitive to 10 years versus 5. I know that there's been some work done from the Austrian group looking at things like PAM50, and then there's other assays like the Oncotype assay that people are looking at to see if they might be predictors. And I think things will filter out as more of these translational studies get done. It would appear, I think the knowledge would be that the more hormone receptor positive the tumor, you know, we've known that from the Oxford overviews, they tend to be more hormonally sensitive, and it would make more sense that those are the ones that are more sensitive to longer duration versus a shorter one, perhaps.
I'm curious about what you're doing in your own practice. First, in postmenopausal women on AIs, are there situations where you go beyond 5 years?
Fantastic question. Partly why I love treating breast cancer is the women are really quite educated and engaged and very proactive in the practice. And they come to you and, you know, they've been on their aromatase inhibitor for 5 years. I just saw one recently and she had 10 positive nodes. Disease-free at 5 years and saying, should I be taking this longer than 5 years? I struggle with this. In some degrees, I do think that the concept of longer hormonal therapy has been proven with the Atlas and Atom, albeit with tamoxifen. It's somewhat hard to fathom to think that that wouldn't be likely possible with the aromatase inhibitors as well. The way I approach it is, what is the residual risk of that woman at 5 years? Has she been compliant with her hormonal therapy and what toxicities has she experienced so far? And if really she's had very little toxicities, her bone mineral density is good, and you're not concerned about the risk of osteoporosis, I'm not sure there's a huge downside as of yet, but I'm very frank and honest with them that I don't know the results based on level one evidence. There's some speculation and corollary studies that we're depending on. And the decision could change in a couple of years once NSABBB42 and MA17R report out.
So what about the more typical situation where this comes up in a patient who's still premenopausal, they're on tamoxifen, it's 5 years, are you generally continuing them?
Yeah, so within British Columbia, which is where I work, we've looked at our own, we have a large clinical outcomes database, and we've looked at what is the residual risk in premenopausal women after 5 years of tamoxifen. We're not fully sure if they're all compliant at the 5 year mark. But it appears that stage two or greater have a residual risk that would probably warrant an absolute risk reduction if they were to take the tamoxifen of at least more than 2-3%. So we've been more so targeting the premenopausal women that have a risk of stage two or greater to consider extended hormonal therapy with tamoxifen.
What about earlier on in terms of ER positive, HER2 negative disease in the adjuvant setting? I see you have several papers. I see one from the European Journal of Cancer, a prospective clinical utility and pharmacoeconomic study of the impact of the 21 gene recurrence score. I saw a paper similar to that at San Antonio. What have we learned nowadays? We're hearing a lot of talk about cost in oncology and quality in oncology. I guess it's been more than a decade now that we've had the Oncotype introduced into clinical practice. What's your global take, first of all, sort of from a population point of view, of what the impact is of integrating this into practice?
You know, I'm a big fan of predictive assays. I think we've been practicing for many years with the only predictive markers being estrogen receptor and HER2. And really, the Oncotype is the first, and it clearly won't be the last. Looking at multiple genes, whether it's actually the genes or the gene products like the RNA here. You know, I think the thing about the Oncotype, which I think is positive, is that many of the prospective clinical utility studies have been very consistent in the results. And the one that we performed in British Columbia showed a 30% change in the delivery of chemo. 20% we removed the delivery, 10% we added it based on the Oncotype score. Basically, this type of proportion was replicated across multiple countries, whether it was in Spain, Germany, Israel, United States, Australia. So I think the consistency of that is very strong. We did do a prospective cost-effective analysis and showed that it was a very cost-effective thing to add the 21 gene recurrence score to your clinical algorithm with a cost-effectiveness ratio in the range of about 7,000 per life years gain. And remember, there is a life years gain to this, meaning that in the patients that you were not suspecting or considering chemotherapy that returned as a high score, there, probably 1 in 4 of them, you'll have prevented a distant metastasis by giving them chemotherapy.
Yeah, I think people focus a lot more on the issue of avoiding chemotherapy. But as you say, when you really think about it, if you're going to maybe prevent a recurrence that might have occurred, not only is that a gigantic clinical event, but there are expenses associated with it too.
Absolutely. The treatment of a recurrence in the metastatic settings is hugely expensive with all the drugs that we have available and clearly to prevent that. And you know, the other thing that's been shown, there was a study done out of the University of Chicago and we did the same. We used a decisional conflict scale. And it's one of the things that we, I think, have a hard time quantifying, though we see it in our clinic, is the struggle that patients and their families have in terms of whether to proceed with chemotherapy or not. It's an extremely difficult decision. And at least the studies that have been done with the 21 gene assay have shown it does reduce decisional conflict. It increases the confidence of both the physician and the patient. And I think that's an important thing that it's hard to quantify, but we all recognize the distress in this situation is dramatic.
How do you incorporate this into your practice? First, do you ever use other assays besides the Oncotype, for example, the MammaPrint?
Yeah, we don't. And so the way I use the Oncotype is clearly predominantly in the ER positive, no negative setting, someone who is medically fit to receive chemo. And for the most part, it's grade 2 to 3. Virtually all the studies show that in a grade 1, a tumor, high ER, low grade, that the change in your decision, meaning that the chances that that will come back as a high recurrence score is 1% to 2% is extremely low. The MammaPrint is something slightly different because it was really done in the Netherlands and looked at an untreated population. So women did not receive any chemo or hormonal therapy. And if you're looking at a patient that just doesn't want to take any treatment at all, that assay might, if it came back as a low risk, say that their risk of a distant relapse is less than 10% at 10 years. But for the most part, I think that the 21 gene assay is the one that's more discriminatory about the effect of adjuvant chemotherapy.
And another question that comes up about that is the use in patients with node positive disease. There's a big trial out there trying to look at that. But what about, are there situations, you know, one node, older patient, for example, where you use Oncotype in a node positive patient?
Right. Yes. So the responder trial, which is a SWOG-led trial, and we are participating here in Canada, including British Columbia, it will be a very important trial. You know, one of the lessons that we've learned in doing that trial, we've enrolled about 65 to 70 patients, is that the refusal to randomization rate is very high, meaning that women that take the results and then decide that the information is sufficient to make a decision rather be randomized to chemo or no chemotherapy. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just the reality. It's a struggle that people are using that information. There is some data to suggest that the lower recurrence score have a limited benefit, albeit the confidence intervals in there is fairly wide. So I think there are some situations that people are taking that information in the node positives and using it to drive clinical decisions.
What about in the neoadjuvant situation? There's a little bit of data out there, but I don't hear too many people talking about it. Although when you think about it, it seems like it would make sense to think about, you know, looking at recurrence score and maybe thinking about neoadjuvant hormonal therapy. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that in North America, we, for the most part, I know there's pockets throughout that do more of this, underutilize neoadjuvant hormonal therapy. The Europeans do this more. And studies actually show that you can downstage a tumor with, albeit you're going to have to be on neoadjuvant hormonal therapy at least 6 months or longer, from a mastectomy to breast conservation with those that are sensitive. Studies have been done. Luca Gianni did do a study that used the 21 gene recurrence score assay to show the ones that had the high recurrence score had a higher PCR rate, which is really in keeping with chemosensitivity. So, you know, I think in the neoadjuvant arena, there's still work to be done in terms of better selection, but there has already been more of the trials now are utilizing these genomic assays. The I-SPY 2 study is using the MammaPrint as a way to get onto the study, and only if you're high score do you actually get randomized to one of the chemotherapy arms.
Another thing I want to ask you about, we saw in San Antonio a meta-analysis looking at bisphosphonates. Can you talk a little bit about what was done there, what they saw, and what you think it meant?
Yeah, that was a surprise. And so this was a presentation by Dr. Rob Coleman. And basically, it's the same group that has done the Oxford overviews that we know for adjuvant polychemotherapy, adjuvant hormonal therapy. And they took not all, but the majority of the trials that have been used with adjuvant bisphosphonates over time and really then had the power to look at subgroups. And what they really showed was that in the subgroup of postmenopausal women, there was a benefit for adjuvant bisphosphonates, regardless of type and whether it's oral or IV, to reduce the incidence of bone mets. And then there was a benefit in terms of breast cancer specific survival. I'm a little bit hesitant because, you know, I think that what you're really doing is you're merging together all the data and you're really looking at a subgroup that wasn't initially planned to look at and didn't really have the biology to support that. This is really an afterthought after a couple of the more recent trials suggest, oh, wait, the postmenopausal is the group that seemed to have the benefit. I'm not arguing that this meta-analysis showed this. I would have loved to see a confirmatory trial, and I think the one confirmatory trial that may come out over time is the one with denosumab to placebo, where they will have a placebo arm because the other SWOG trial does not have a placebo arm. So, you know, I think if there's a reason to give a bisphosphonate, in other words, if you have a postmenopausal woman, you're giving 5 years at least of an aromatase inhibitor, she has a low bone marrow density, you're going to give it to her for her bone strength anyways, then sure, why not? Someone with normal bone marrow density and not a high risk of recurrence, I'm not sure. I think it's a given that you give it to all postmenopausal women, to be honest with you.
Why don't we go through your cases? And I immediately noticed your first case, 30-year-old woman who's diagnosed with breast cancer at 12-week gestation. What happened with this lady?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, she's on my hospital ward right now. You know, back in 2008, when she presented in her first trimester, I mean, there's a couple factors that concern you. There's quite strong data to suggest women 40 years or younger, some people use the cutoff less than 40 years, but definitely under 35, have a worse prognosis, this young woman with breast cancer. And historical data, in fact, suggests that those that are under 40 with ER-positive disease actually have a worse prognosis than ER-negative disease, suggesting there's something more unique in the hormone receptor positive young woman with breast cancer. So that was a poor prognostic factor. It's there. And then the development during the first trimester really limited to your ability, meaning that, you know, she had her surgery and we had to wait a little bit to deliver the adjuvant chemotherapy. So both of those factors, I think, were extremely worrisome. She delivered a healthy baby and the child's great, doing well. She tested negative for BRCA1 and 2, but unfortunately, as one would have possibly predicted, she had a metastatic relapse 3 years after her original diagnosis on adjuvant tamoxifen.
What was your thinking when that happened?
Yeah, so she presented fairly abruptly with right upper quadrant pain, had a rapid ultrasound, suggested a mass. So clearly we went after it and we did a biopsy, number one, to confirm that it was metastatic breast cancer, and number two, to recheck the hormone receptor status and the HER2 status. And it was very similar to the original profile, ER positive, HER2 negative. She was young. She had visceral disease. We wanted to be aggressive. She had adjuvant anthracycline taxane, albeit it was about 3 years before. But this was several years ago. And so we followed the bevacizumab data, and we gave her actually CAPE and bevacizumab because, you know, there is definitely data to suggest it increases PFS. I think that the controversy is, does it improve OS? But to her, PFS was important. And the other thing is the combination of CAPE and bevacizumab was very well tolerated. So in her, I think she felt that that was something she wanted to pursue, and she was on that for 12 months. We tried to downstage the tumor to make it surgically resectable, and she did go to surgery. But unfortunately, I think there was more disease there than was appreciated on imaging, so it wasn't fully resected. On progression, we treated her with second-line platinum, a cisplatinum and gemcitabine regimen.
And what's her current situation?
So over the last 2.5, close to 3 years now, she's actually had fairly good quality of life with treatment with her young family. But in the last couple of months, the pace has really picked up. We actually re-biopsied her on a second occasion because the pace of the disease had changed. And in fact, the tumor is now estrogen negative. So it's a triple negative tumor. So this is clearly that's been described in the literature, including work that we've done, that 20% of the time, you know, you lose the ER. And so her disease has really picked up in pace, and she's been on the weekly paclitaxel with an experimental drug on a phase one study and is minimally, if very at best, responding to treatment.
I'm kind of curious what's been going on with her personally. How old is her child now?
So her child is 5.5 years old.
And she has a spouse or
the
father?
Right. She has a very supportive spouse, a very supportive mother and father. And you get to know these patients so well over the last 2.5 to 3 years. And we've had very frank discussions about, you know, when the pace of disease picks up and whatnot. And she's realistic that, unfortunately, it's not curable. And at some point, we will run out of treatment options. But she's also tried to be as positive about situations where her quality of life has been well enough to take a trip to back east, to take a trip down to Disneyland with her kids, have quality time to be able to be at home and spend time with. She has 3 children in total. And so there have been good times. And as you know, there are other times that are extremely challenging.
You know, over the last couple of years, we've done Satellite Symposium San Antonio, and Dr. Sledge has been very vocal about the issue of end-of-life care, feeling that there's too much hospitalization, too much chemotherapy, too many ICUs. And I don't know, in my own mind, I'm not in practice now, but just talking to people in practice, I'm not so sure whether I really buy into that or not. I think it's often a very complicated situation. What's your take on that? And, you know, for example, in this lady, as you sort of think forward, at what point are you going to be thinking about talking to her about not using, you know, anti-tumor therapy, about hospice, et cetera?
Yeah, you're right. I think there's different jurisdictions that have different patterns of practice, different philosophies. I'm more like your sense, at least my practice has been, I rarely have patients admitted to hospital towards end of life. Almost half of them pass away at home with their family around them, or others are in a hospice. So we've had that discussion with her. She has young kids. And one of the things we did very early was say, make sure your will is in place so that, you know, because it's such an unpredictable time. Someone on chemotherapy could develop febrile neutropenia and pass on. They need to make sure the kids are taken care of from a guardianship point of view. Those loose ends cannot be left loose at the end. So we've had that discussion. Palliative care has been involved. Basically, I've told her we might have one more line of therapy. Then after that, we really, you know, the likelihood of benefit is so low, it's much better to focus in on symptom management.
Now, she received exemestane and everolimus. What happened when she got it?
So that was the reason we did the biopsy. So she got everolimus and exemestane, and in fact, she did develop mucositis, though we dose reduced. But within 6 weeks, the tumor was growing. And so we said, this is not behaving like a hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So we biopsied it, and in fact, it was triple negative. We also did a biopsy because we're doing a unique study here in British Columbia where we're doing next-gen sequencing on tumors. And we're getting information on somatic mutations, translocations. We're also getting the transcriptome data. So you're looking at the RNAs. We're trying to come up with different sort of activated or tumor suppressor pathways that are underactivated as what might be driving this tumor.
It kind of seems like not that much has come out of that kind of approach in breast cancer compared to, for example, lung cancer. Is that your conclusion and why?
Yeah, I think we are still at the very early stages of harnessing the information from genomics in terms of integrating it into clinical care. And the reality, I think, are twofold. Number one, breast cancer is a very complicated with multiple redundant pathways. So there's not often one simple pathway that's altered. And secondly, I think a lot of the drugs for the other pathways are still being tested in early phase development or phase two trials. And we don't know that these drugs are going to be active if that pathway is active. And so again, if you go back to the Bolero 2 study with exemestane everolimus, they did get tumor tissue of the primary. They have done limited next-gen sequencing and were not able to identify a genomic profile that had more benefit or less benefit.
So let's talk about your 57-year-old lady.
Okay.
Can you kind of talk about what happened with her?
Yeah, so this was a woman that was a T2, 3-centimeter grade 2 tumor, whose tumor was modestly estrogen receptor positive and no 0-4 sentinel lymph nodes, and had her standard surgery and did proceed to go on to getting an oncotype as part of our clinical utility study here. And I think this illustrates the challenge. Her score was 25, so it's smack in the middle of an intermediate risk category. And I hear different people describe different utilities of how they utilize a score in the intermediate risk. I think it's very clear when I read the literature, high-risk score, most people offer chemotherapy. Low-risk score, most people don't. And in the intermediate risk, it really is, I've heard people say, oh, it's completely useless. I don't take away from that that the information is useless. The way I use that information is I then go back to the patient and say, listen, this is based on what we know from how this assay was assessed on the retrospective studies. Probably the most benefit you would get from chemotherapy here is no more than 4 to 5%, rather than like a 1 to 2% in the low risk category and more than a 20% in the high risk. And then I describe to them, if that is something that you would go through 3 months of chemotherapy, then we'll go through that journey together. More than not, they're like, thank you for that information. That's not the type of benefit to me that's worth going through chemo, because you're describing to me maybe a 1 to 2% chance of significant long-term toxicities, whether it be neuropathy, fatigue, whatever it is. So I do find that information useful. And in this situation, we opted not to give chemo. We gave hormonal therapy, and she's on it for a plan for at least 5 years.
So she's on an AI?
She's on an AI, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, how's she doing?
She's doing well. I mean, I see them every 3 months, and she describes the typical slight arthralgias in the morning, but works through that. We've been talking about exercise. There's a recent study from San Antonio that women on aromatase inhibitors doing exercise had less arthralgias over time. And, you know, just to say, as a following up to our previous discussion, her bone marrow density shows a borderline osteoporosis at minus 2.5. She's otherwise healthy. And so we've opted to proceed with a bisphosphonate, an oral bisphosphonate.
An oral bisphosphonate?
Yeah.
Which one?
I've given her Fosamax once a week. So, you know, I think that one could argue that that wasn't one of the agents given in the clinical trials. But if you think about it, one of them was Clodronate, which is really one of the weakest oral bisphosphonates available. And the other was zoledronic acid, which is one of the most industrial strength bisphosphonates. And their feeling was, regardless of the class and the agent, there was no difference. And they all work by blocking osteoclast activity. So rationally, there should be no difference in my view of giving a different bisphosphonate that is standardly used for osteoporosis. So I'm really treating her for osteoporosis and not so much as for the reduction in breast cancer recurrence, because I'm not 100% convinced. But I said, listen, you might get that as an additional benefit.
So thinking back to your paper, looking at sort of the global impact of introducing these kinds of predictors like Oncotype into practice in terms of less chemotherapy. So here's a lady with a 3 centimeter tumor who's not getting chemotherapy. And I think certainly if we didn't have anything else to go on, she probably would be getting chemotherapy.
You're absolutely right. 3 centimeter grade 2, otherwise completely healthy. And her ER is only all red 6 to 9. That concerns me a little bit. And so, yeah, if she was, you know, in the high risk category, which I was concerned about, I definitely would have given her chemotherapy. But yeah, she would have been that 20% spared chemotherapy.
So I guess another thing conceivably to think about, I think there was a paper on this last year looking at Oncotype in metastatic disease. Mm. And I was just kind of curious thinking about it. You know, when you see, for example, like your first patient with relapsed disease, if you know that this patient in the past had, you know, a low Oncotype, do you tend to sort of push the hormones more as opposed to chemo? And if they had a higher Oncotype, and again, in the metastatic setting, do you maybe think twice about hormones or maybe think about everolimus, or does it affect you at all?
Yeah, you know, I was there in the audience when that was presented, and my initial reaction was, okay, that's interesting. And then I thought about it a little bit longer. And I think in the metastatic setting, what we have the ability or quote luxury to do is really assess for response. And we can do that in a very timely manner. Some people do it 6 weeks, some people do it at 12 weeks. And so I think that the Oncotype to me would not provide much more information than what I know about, because we do know the lower Oncotype scores tend to be high ER all red and the low Oncotype scores tend to be low ER. And so they kind of fit with what we would think more chemosensitive versus not. But because you can actually monitor for response closely, and you're going to do it anyways, I'm not sure the Oncotype in the metastatic setting is going to be as clinically useful.